This little book, God Calling, is a very wonderful book. It has, it was written by two little old ladies who choose to remain anonymous. It's called, I think I mentioned, God Calling. And one day they were sitting together and speaking of God, and they remembered what Jesus said, that wherever two or three were gathered together in his name, there he would be in the midst of them. And so they started praying together. And as they prayed, one of them had a paper and pencil, and thoughts started coming to her from the Christ within herself, and she started writing these thoughts. They both have contributed to this book, and it's a beautiful book. There's a prayer, an admonition for every single day in the year. I thought I would read the one for January 2nd, which is today. And the title of it is Arm of Love. You are to help to save others. Never let one day pass when you have not reached out an arm of love to someone outside your home. A note, a letter, a visit. Help in some way. Be full of joy. Joy saves. Joy cures. Joy in me. In every ray of sunlight, every smile, every act of kindness or love, every trifling service, joy. Each day do something to lift another soul out of the sea of sin or disease or doubt into which man has fallen. I still walk today by the lakeside and call my disciples to follow me and to become fishers of men. The helping hand is needed that raises the helpless to courage, to struggle, to faith, to health. Love and laugh. Love and laughter are the beckoners to faith and courage and success. Trust on, love on, joy on. Refuse to be downcast. Refuse to be checked in your upward climb. Love and laugh. I am with you. I bear your burdens. Cast your burden upon me and I will sustain thee. And then, in very lightheartedness, you turn and help another with the burden that is pressing too heavily upon him or her. How many burdens can you lighten this year? How many hearts can you cheer? How many souls can you help? And in giving, you gain. Good measure, pressed down and running over. I, your Lord, have said it. Isn't that beautiful? We can do that. It will be a wonderful thing. Our Bible chapter this morning is from St. Matthew, chapter 6, beginning with verse 38. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor, and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. You know, if we could live everything that it says in these few verses, we would indeed attain our God realization in a hurry. This is the beginning of a new year. And I have chosen for my subject, Walk the Second Mile. And I've taken it from this chapter. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. We know that we must take the first step before we can reach our journey's end, and many steps after that. Every year we make new resolutions, but we keep them for perhaps a few days, a week, or a few weeks, and then we forget about them, and we go our own merry way. Now that is not true of everyone. I keep repeating this, and I say it with all the sincerity of my soul. I think that we have some of the most wonderful souls in this group that God could wish for anywhere. I know of people who, the minute they get in from work, sit down and meditate. I know people that when they go outside and they sit down for a few moments, they meditate. They are constantly opening their door to all who want to come, constantly giving, constantly doing for others who are in need. They are living the life. And these people also are absolutely perfect in their worship, their adoration, their love, their service to God, Christ, and Guru. It's a wonderful thing when you attain that state of consciousness and have that constant desire in your heart to do that which is necessary in order to take you to the realization of your oneness with God. As it says in here, the Old Testament is full of it. It used to be that we would think an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But the Christ came and he changed that admonition. And all of the things that he tells us now is to turn the other cheek 7 times 70. To learn to love your enemies, which is a very difficult thing. But you know, really, we have no enemies in this world, except we think we have. This is true. Because the one who appears before you as your enemy is sometimes your very greatest friend. If you will but see God in that form, and see that whatever is coming out of that form in thought, word, and deed is given to you by God as a test, perhaps to make you look into the mirror of your own soul and see wherein you can better yourself. Are the things that this individual says about you really true? Can you improve yourself? And if not, do you not have the very great privilege of loving God in that form anyway? It is something to forgive. Now, can you forgive somebody if you don't forget what they have done? Yes, you can. You can forgive them in your heart. You can keep on going. But somehow, some of the experiences which come to us are so deeply ingrained within us, so put upon into the subconscious mind, that we don't forget them. I remember things, as I'm sure all of you do, that have happened to me in my lifetime. Not all of them bad, but we are prone to remember the things which caused us a great deal of trouble or hurt or pain. We don't forget them easily. But as you look back on those things which have happened to you, that somebody has said, thought, or done to you, or just some happening in life, some experience, are they not the most tremendous events of your life? That's why you remember them. And the reason you do is not that you may continue to dwell in bitterness, but rather that you realize that you have been able to find the power of overcoming within yourself. The power of overcoming. And the more you do that, you see, the more you become master of yourself. It is a very difficult thing to become master of yourself, because you've been living with the human ego since you were born. And that ego has taken off on an awful lot of barnacles on your ship of life. And they're very difficult to scrape off. That consciousness that of the fact that I am doing of the supreme I, the royal I of God, who really and truthfully does everything through us and for us, is very deeply embedded in our consciousness. And we don't get rid of that easily. The least little thing, we are hurt. And sometimes rightfully so, because people are very selfish in the things that they think, say, and do sometimes. They are very inconsiderate. And if you don't react in a way that lets them know that they have been inconsiderate and selfish, you retard their progress, in effect. But you must be careful how you do it. You must do it only the way that God directs you to do. But you must be willing to turn the other cheek, to forgive them, to go back into it if God so directs you, and to keep on being their friend. That's a good New Year's resolution, a very good New Year's resolution. And if each day, as the little article that I read to you said, if you will try to do good for someone outside of your home or within your home, you know, there are a great many people who are just the essence of light, the essence of love, the essence of all that they should be, all the charm, the charisma on the outside, so that everybody on the outside thinks they're wonderful people. And yet, with their own family and their own home, they are not very easy to live with. Charity begins at home. And your family was given to you, every family since the beginning of time, to teach you, in the human sense, how you must serve God's greater family. And unless you can be what you should be to your husband, to your wife, to your father, to your mother, to your brothers and sisters, and the friends who come to your home, you cannot say that truly you are following the law, the will of God. There are many people who certainly evidence the fact that they are like the Janus faced God. We all are, in one sense, but some more than others. And so we wear this cloak. Now, in this chapter this morning, it tells about if someone asks you for your coat, give them your cloak also. What does this mean? It means that if they want your outer coat, give it to them. This is your worldly possession. Rhonda was the perfect example of that. You will all remember, those of you who have read the stories in The Vision of God and In Quest of God, how the thief came to his cave one evening, and the mothers and the different ones, devotees in the village, had provided him very generously with all of the things that he would need. They had even built shelves on the side of the cave, and they had brought him food in glass jars. They had brought him a rug. They had brought him coverings for his body. And in the middle of the night, along came a thief and entered the cave and demanded that he give him all of his possessions. Ramdas said, "Certainly, take them all. You are he." So the man took everything that he could see in the room. And then he looked at the blanket that was covering Ramdas. He looked at the very garb that he was wearing. And he wanted those too. And Ramdas let him have them. Well, the next day, the mothers came up from the village as usual to gather around the feet of the saint and talk. And they found that he was destitute of all of the worldly possessions that had been given to him. And so they, as only the Indians can, there was much chatter about it. And they were just very angry to think that these things had been stolen from the saint. But he said Ramdas didn't matter at all. But the women were so incensed that they all went out and they started gathering things together again to replace those things which had been stolen. And Ramdas said, "Wherein did he lose anything?" He said, he wound up by having much more than he had in the first place. It was only God who had come to take his own and then to give him more in return, which also is his own. Now, that's a wonderful attitude. And how many people, particularly in the Western world, can do that? We are so filled, you see, with the idea of possession all the time. Everything is ours. Now, sometimes it's necessary to remind other people that things are ours, because they have to learn the lesson of courtesy. They have to learn that they must keep their hands off of other people's possessions and that they must get permission to use things before they take them. But many people are not like that. I can remember one instance of two girls in a family, and no matter what one got, the other one always managed to use it first. And, of course, always a fight ensued. They grew up, And today they are very close, but that was not always the way. And it seemed the littlest one was always getting the wrong end of the deal, you know? So we must, in that way, regard other people's possessions. There are some people that say, well, if we have nothing of our own, if everything belongs to God, why can't we just help ourselves? That's a lovely idea, but I wonder where we'd go with it. Now, again, it says here that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. I've explained this, not resisting evil, to you many times before, but I will do it again. It means not to pay attention, not to concentrate upon evil. Now, this is in the red-letter part of the Bible. Jesus said it. Don't resist evil. That seems a strange thing to do. And he contradicted himself totally, it would seem, when he said, resist the devil and he will disappear from you. But they are, neither one of them, contradictory. When evil comes at you, just don't pay any attention to it. Because if you do, you give it power. Put your mind on God alone. He is your salvation. He will take care of you. You don't have to be thinking about evil. It's the same as any bad habit that you want to get rid of. If you think of the habit that you want to get rid of all the time, you give power to that habit. But if you forget the habit and just think of what you want to become, and think first of God and give the whole thing to Him, and every time the thought of what you want to get rid of comes to your mind, just put it out of your mind totally as though it didn't exist. Because when you think about it, you're giving power to it. And it's going to rise up and it's going to fight you. Evil cannot fight by itself. It must dissolve. It must disappear. I'm sure that you will all remember the story about the devil and the bamboo pole. And how the man had all these tremendous desires to the point where finally he went to an individual in India who knew how to give out mantrams. And he asked him to give him a mantram that would bring Satan in front of him so he could be his disciple and therefore have all of his wishes fulfilled. He was going to make a bargain with him. And the man was shocked. But finally the man who had so many desires talked him in to giving him a mantram, which he was to say 1,000 times a day for 40 days. So the man went home and he said this, and at the end of the time, Satan appeared in all of his glory, complete with horns, pitchfork, and tail. And he said, yes, my son, what can I do for you? And he said, well, Satan, I have so many desires. I have no money with which to fulfill these desires. And so I conceive the idea of becoming your disciple if you will grant my all of my desires. So Satan scratched his head and thought for a moment or two, and he said, all right, I will accept what you say upon one condition. He said, what's that? He said, that is that you will keep me busy all the time, because if you fail to do so, he said, I will return and destroy you. Well, the man had so many desires that he thought that this would never stop, and he'd never be in trouble with this. So he agreed to do this. So Satan asked him what his first desire was, and his first desire was for the most beautiful castle in all the world. So Satan said, very well, and he went out. He was gone for quite a long time, and finally he returned. He said, well, my son, your castle is ready. Would you like to see it? Oh, yes, he said. So he went with Satan, and he looked at the castle, and here was the most beautiful castle that the world had ever known. It was all made out of gold and silver and encrusted with jewels, and it was just the dream that anyone, the most perfect dream that anyone could have fulfilled. So he said, what is your next wish? Well, he wanted the castle furnished with all the most costly works of art, all of the most costly furnishings that he could find anywhere, the most beautiful. So again, Satan was gone for quite a while, and then he wanted, inasmuch as he had a castle, to have a kingdom. This, in turn, was given to him. He wanted a wife. He wanted children. He wanted subjects that he could rule All of these things came. So his desires kept growing and growing. He took on more territory, more things and more things, and he was just having the time of his life. But all of a sudden, one day, after he had requested something of Satan, he sat down, he started thinking about what he would ask him to give him or do for him next, and he couldn't think of a thing. He had every single thing he could think of, and he became panicky, and he said to himself, "What shall I do? Satan told me that if I didn't keep him busy, he was going to come back and destroy me, and I can't think of another thing I want." So he ran in hot haste to a holy man that he'd heard about down the road, and he threw himself at his feet. He said, "Oh, Holy Father," he said, "you must save me." And he said, "Well, my son, what is your problem?" He said, "Well, I had so many desires, I had no money to fulfill them." So he said, "I made a pact with Satan that if he would fulfill all my desires, I would become his disciple." And he said he agreed, but with the condition that I keep him busy or he would destroy me. He said, "Now I have everything I need. I can't think of another thing. He's going to destroy me. You must save me." He said, "My son, this is a very grievous thing that you have done." He said, "Are you sure that you are sorry for what you have done?" "Oh, yes," he said, "I am deeply repentant." He said, "If you will only save me," he said, "I will come and sit at your feet and become a holy person. I will think only of God." He said, "Very well, my son, I will tell you what to do." He said, "The next time Satan comes in front of you," he said, "you tell him to go get a bamboo pole and stick it in the ground and to run up and down that pole until you tell him to stop." So Satan appeared before him, and he told him to go get the bamboo pole and stick it in the ground and run up and down the pole until he told him to stop. And then this man kept his word, and he went and sat at the feet of the saint and learned the truth of God, and himself became a great saint. And finally Satan got so tired running up and down the bamboo pole that he ran away, and he was never seen again. Now that's a perfect story to go with this injunction by the Christ to resist not evil. If you don't think about it, he has to run away because he gets all tired out fighting by himself, you see. Now about this cloak again. Give him, this man that comes and asks for your cloak, the outer cloak of yourself also. Give him your friendship. Give him your worldly goods, give him anything. And also give him of the spirit within yourself. Everybody wears two coats, you see. The coat of the spirit, which is also the essence, and then this outer coat, this coat of human personality. Today we are so engrossed in government that actually we are a people governed rather than governing. It is true. This also applies to ourselves. Did you ever stop to think about that? That the world has become so complex. We are so involved with the outer things, with the huge societies that we have built, the huge organizations and things to take care of this complex society, that we have forgotten totally to learn to govern ourselves, to become masters of ourselves. And it is high time that we do this. You see, society never goes forward until man makes the adjustment within himself, but rather it retrogresses. As long as man fails to govern himself, to control himself, to be master of himself, the world around him deteriorates. We have seen this as a matter of fact in history. We have seen whole continents go underneath the sea. We ourselves in this day have not seen this particular part, but we are told that these things exist. And as far as Atlantis and Lemuria are concerned, there have been divers who have gone down and, it is said, have discovered cities and pots of gold and different ornaments and things like that in the nation. Why does this happen? It happens because the vibrations that each man sends forth from himself, as far as his thoughts, his words, and his actions are concerned, are against the laws of God. They are all of them vibratory, and they all go out and meet together until you have just a terrible disruption in every respect. And so it affects not only all other men, it affects not only the history of the world, but it affects nature as well. And so she cries out in pain. And so we have huge tidal waves, we have huge earthquakes, we have many things happen that are very terrible, with nature resisting what man has done. And it is high time that we remember that this is the beginning of the last time when all must turn their face toward God. Every single one of us must do this. We must start this climb up the mountain of our own being. Now, we're not going to see the whole world changed into a thing of perfection during the lifetime of anyone who sits here. I don't care how young they are, because molding yourself into an image of God is a very slow process. And this ego, this antichrist within yourself, is so firmly embedded that you don't want to let him go, and he doesn't want to let you go. The minute you, as an individual soul, start to think about giving up certain things, certain individuals, and of replacing them with new ideas, new patterns of living that will make you a better person, that will make you more spiritual, this opposing force within yourself comes forth. It is a bad thief on your cross, which is your body. And it opposes you every inch of the way. It will tempt you with the most tempting temptation. And the master with whom I studied many times said this prayer, "Make thyself more tempting than temptation. It is thee alone I want." How wonderful that is. When you give up the idea of being tempted by anything in this world, but only God. And you know he is the world, because all things stem from him. But you must learn to choose the best in thought, in word, in deed. You must become that, not just talk about it, and not just use it and put on a coat for Sunday to come to church and listen and then forget about it immediately. But you must take these things into your consciousness, into your hearts, and actually make them a part of you, of your life. There are three things that every individual wants in this life. One of them is life itself. That's the first and most important one, this idea of self-preservation. You want life, but you don't want it to end at all. And you don't want a life filled with poverty and disease. You want a life, and you want it perfect. Is that not true? It really is. You must have that. And then you want truth. You're not satisfied when you come to the beginning of the spiritual path just with intellectual things. I mean the higher path. Just with things that satisfy the intellect, things that have been written perhaps in the scriptures or that have been handed down by word of mouth for centuries. You've come to the point where you want to know what it's all about. You want the truth behind the parables. And the time comes when you're willing to pay any price in order to get that truth. Why? Because you can't stand not to. You're constantly hung, you see, between your ideals and the fulfillment of those ideals, the things you want to be, and your lack in doing what is necessary to become that. The things that you want to possess and your lack of possession by the net entails your being always in a state of dis-ease. You're always frustrated. Is there any way out of this? Yes, there is. And that is to save your soul. What do you mean by saving? What do we mean by saving our souls? How can we save them? We save them for God. We don't use them for ourselves. We turn every single part of our lives over to him. Every thought, every word, every deed is done for him alone. Everything which comes to us, we give thanks to him, knowing that it is his and that he has poured his blessings upon us and given it to us for our use. The third thing that every man wants is love. And he searches for it in many ways. But the only way, the only place that he finds true love is in the sanctuary of his own soul, when he comes face to face with God within himself. Who is it that leads him there? It is that infinite Christ Spirit, that one who is the firstborn of every creature, as the scriptures tell us. Not just one who lived in a body 2,000 years ago as the example, but he said that he was with us always. He is the head of the church, which is, he is the life within us. And so what he came to do was to save us from the sin of separation from God. to make us know that until the day comes when we are willing to surrender ourselves and all that we call our own at the feet of God, we still live in the idea of separation from God. And that mustn't be. Do you realize what it means to have union with God? To be lifted up into His arms of bliss? To have every thought, every word, every deed that flows into your consciousness be from Him? To be able to separate and to actually choose what you're going to live with. You can go on for the rest of your life blaming people for things that they have done to hurt you. But that isn't going to take you anyplace. You're going to retrogress. You can't live on hatred. This is the little ego feeling sorry for itself. And God has given that individual that particular test in order that He may prove if he is, like they say, you separate the men from the boys. Because you are still a child, and not childlike, but still a child, childish, if you cannot rise above the tests which God gives you and put your full attention upon Him, wanting Him alone. And if you will do that, the abundance that will come to you will be beyond your wildest dreams. And that is in every phase of your life and of your living. Everything. Your life will roll smoothly as it never has before. Now let us take the subject for the sermon this morning. He who asks you to walk with him a mile, let then walk twain with him. There's a story told about this that happened in the days of the Romans. And there was a boy called David that was standing by the wayside. And the road extended as far both ways as he could see. And all the people were going back and forth and back and forth. And he thought to himself, someday I'm going to keep on walking and see where this road ends. And as he watched, he saw the various Roman soldiers around. And he hated them because David was a Jew. And all the Jews were subject to the Romans. And he saw one particular Roman soldier walking along, carrying his sack. And as he looked at him, he thought how much he hated him. And he thought to himself about the laws that the Romans had imposed upon the Jews. Because one of the laws was that any Roman who asked a Jew to walk with him a mile, that must be done. So the Roman came along and he stopped a moment and he put down his pack and he stood there. And the boy looked at him and he looked away. But all of a sudden the attention of the Roman soldier was called to the boy. And he picked up his pack. He said, "Here, carry this for me a mile." The boy wanted to do anything and everything but that. He wanted to run away. How he hated that Roman soldier because this edict had been imposed upon him. But he knew he had to conform to the law, so he picked up the sack and he started following the Roman soldier. And as he followed it, he thought, "Walk a mile, walk a mile." And it was just like a chant going through his head, "Walk a mile. At the end of this, I can lay down my burden." But all of a sudden, he remembered that a young man had visited their neighborhood not too long ago, and he had followed him to a certain place and listened to what he had to say. And he had said, "And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain." And he thought, that's a peculiar thing. Here I hate this Roman soldier. I don't want to follow him at all. And yet this young master told me that I must follow him 2 miles. And he kept thinking about that and thinking about it. Finally, the Roman soldier stopped and he said, "It is the end of your mile. Give me back your pack." And he said, without even consciously thinking of what he was saying, "I'll go with you another mile." The Roman soldier was absolutely astounded. For the first time, David looked into the face of the Roman soldier. He saw that he was a young man and that he was very tired. Apparently, he had come a very long way. And he said to him, "You look very tired. Have you come a long way?" And the Roman soldier was touched by his interest. He said, "Yes, I have. I'm very tired. It is very kind of you to offer to carry my pack another mile." "Oh, I don't mind," he said. And so, instead of walking in front of him, the Roman soldier fell back. And together they walked. And as they walked, David told him about this young master who had told him that when somebody asked him to walk a mile, that he must go with them 2 miles. And the Roman soldier said, "Why, my, what a wonderful thing." He said, "I would like to meet that young master." And so David told him that he hoped one day he would. Finally, it came to the end of the second mile, and David knew that he had to go back. And so as he put down the pack for the Roman to pick up, the Roman shook hands with him, and he said, "Goodbye, friend." And David looked at him, and he said, "Goodbye, friend." He had walked 1 mile behind an enemy, and the second mile, he had found a friend. It's a wonderful story. So let us remember that in the new year. Let us dedicate our thoughts, our words, and our actions to God alone. Let us spend our time in meditating upon Him, in serving Him in every form that we meet. And at the end of this year, the end of this road, we will have found the friend of all friends, the Christ within ourselves.